AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Have you ever paused and truly wondered what it takes to be on the front lines, responding to the unexpected day in and day out?
It's like something to think about.
Imagine a job where every single moment could pivot from routine to a critical, life-altering event, where your decisions, made in, a fraction of a second, can quite literally change lives.
That's exactly it.
That's the incredibly dynamic world of a peace officer on patrol. And today, we're embarking on a comprehensive, incredibly detailed, deep dive into what it truly means to be that first responder.
Mm-hmm.
We know you're looking for a shortcut to being well-informed, to grasp complex information quickly and effectively. And that's precisely what this deep dive is designed for. We want to really break it down for you.
And to help us navigate this intricate world, we'll be continuously referring back to a foundational framework that underpins nearly every action, the Critical Decision-Making Model, or CDM.
CDM.
This model is essentially the roadmap, the guiding philosophy that shapes every decision an officer makes, from the most, mundane community interaction to the most high-stakes, life-or-death scenario.
Wow.
Understanding the CDM is truly key to grasping the nuances of policing. It offers significant insights into how officers operate and, importantly, why they do what they do within our communities.
Our mission today is to give you, especially if you're someone completely new to the intricacies of police patrol and decision making, a truly comprehensive and deep understanding. We're going to journey from the very basic objectives of what patrol is all about.
The fundamentals.
Exactly. All the way through the subtle complexities of nuanced interactions and even critical incident responses. What makes this deep dive unique is that the insights we're sharing come directly from core peace officer training materials.
Right, from the source.
Offering you a rare insider's perspective on the foundational elements of this vital and, let's be honest, often misunderstood profession. So let's get started.
Let's do it.
Okay, let's unpack this. When we talk about law enforcement, the patrol function isn't just a part of it. It's genuinely the backbone. It's where the rubber meets the road, right?
Absolutely. It's the most visible presence.
The most visible presence that directly connects the police department to the community they serve. So it's not just about, chasing down suspects, is it? It's so much more nuanced than that simple picture.
Oh, absolutely. The patrol function is incredibly multifaceted. It encompasses several core objectives that really work in tandem, creating, you could say, a robust safety net for the community.
Okay.
First, and perhaps most fundamentally, is the duty to preserve the peace.
Preserve the peace.
This isn't just about reacting to disturbances after they happen. It's about maintaining order through an officer's mere presence and proper action, as mandated by law, actually.
So just being there can make a difference.
Think about it. An officer doesn't even have to say a word sometimes. Just the visible presence of a patrol car or an officer on foot can subtly shift the entire dynamic of a street corner, often preventing issues before they even bubble to the surface. It's almost like an invisible force field of deterrence, you know?
So it's a preventative measure just by being there. That's a powerful and I think often overlooked aspect.
No.
What else is part of this core mission?
Precisely. Next is preventing crime by actively reducing opportunities.
Reducing opportunities. How does that work?
This is a deeply proactive stance. It's rooted in what many experts consider the gold standard in crime prevention, stopping it before it starts. Officers achieve this by making their presence known, deterring potential offenders, and addressing those minor issues.
Like the small stuff.
Exactly. Those small signs of disorder before they escalate into larger problems. It's about methodically closing the windows of opportunity for crime to occur.
Got it. Okay. And when crime does happen, what's the objective there? Because it still does happen.
Right. Inevitably. Then we move to suppressing crime. This involves a timely response to crimes in progress and, critically, the proper investigation of offenses. Speed and thoroughness are absolutely essential here to mitigate harm and gather crucial evidence.
And that leads to?
Following that, a direct and crucial outcome of effective investigations is apprehending suspects. This is the culmination of the investigative process, bringing those responsible for crimes into custody.
Okay, peace, prevention, suppression, apprehension. What about the less criminal or, you know, enforcement focused aspects of their job? Is there more?
Oh, definitely. That brings us to regulating non-criminal conduct. This objective is all about fostering and maintaining positive officer-citizen relationships to protect life and property.
Ah, the community aspect.
Precisely. It recognizes that law enforcement's role isn't solely punitive, you know, focused on arrests and citations. It's profoundly about community, about building rapport and trust, so citizens feel comfortable approaching officers with concerns that might not be criminal in nature, but still impact public safety and well-being.
So being a resource, not just
a responder, exactly. Okay. Being a resource.
That paints a much broader and more complex picture than just the reactive chasing bad guys image many people might have.
Mm.
So if we're looking for that shortcut to being well-informed, why does patrol truly matter in the grand scheme? What's the big takeaway here?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, patrol is fundamental for two main reasons: protection and service.
Protection and service.
Protection, as we noted, is rooted in crime prevention, that powerful idea that stopping crime before it happens is the most effective approach. This involves both proactive measures, like those visible patrols, and reactive responses, like timely investigations.
And service.
And then there's service. This emphasizes the officer's role as an integral, approachable part of the community they serve. When officers are seen as partners in safety and problem solving, rather than just enforcers, well, it significantly helps in building that crucial trust we mentioned earlier. It fosters a truly collaborative environment for public safety. It transforms policing from something that's done to a community to something that's done with a community.
Done with a community. Yep. I like that. That's a powerful foundation. Now, an effective patrol isn't just about showing up, is it? It's built on meticulous, almost obsessive preparation.
Oh, absolutely. Preparation is key.
This deep dive into peace officer training materials really highlights three crucial elements that allow officers to be truly effective and safe on the street. First, a deep understanding of their proper beat characteristics.
Knowing their turf.
Exactly. Then maintaining equipment and physical readiness, and finally cultivating the proper mental conditioning or mindset.
And what's fascinating here is, well, how much of this work is about what's happening inside the officer, not just outside.
The internal game.
Exactly. Mental conditioning is paramount. It's described in the materials as the single most important factor in officer survival.
Wow, the single most important.
That's what they emphasize. The transition from civilian life to the unique psychological pressures of police work requires significant mental and emotional adaptation. Factors involved in this psychological preparedness include cultivating a healthy, resilient attitude, sociological and psychological maturity, both formal and informal education, and a strong personal value system.
That value system must be critical for guiding actions.
Especially when facing difficult ethical dilemmas, yes, it's their compass.
So it's about cultivating a specific internal state, a kind of psychological armor. Are there specific attitudes officers are trained to avoid that could undermine this? Things they need to watch out for in themselves?
Absolutely. Officers are explicitly taught to recognize and avoid attitudes that are counterproductive to job performance and, crucially, to positive community relations.
Like what?
Well, this includes tendencies towards isolationism and ostracizing others, which can lead to detachment and a lack of empathy. They must also guard against becoming overly paranoid and regarding all people suspiciously or as would-be criminals.
That sounds like a trap you could easily fall into.
It can be. And it severely hinders their ability to engage positively and impartially with the community. Finally, withdrawing from or failing to be a normal, integrated part of the community is a critical attitude to avoid, as it directly undermines that service aspect of their role we just talked about.
Right.
It's a delicate and continuous balance, maintaining essential vigilance while avoiding corrosive cynicism.
That internal game sounds incredibly challenging, requiring constant self-awareness. But let's talk about the more tangible aspects. Physical preparation. This is where, you know, the analogy of a surgeon preparing for a complex operation or an athlete getting ready for a championship really comes to mind.
It's a great analogy.
Every detail matters, right down to the shine on their shoes, because lives can literally depend on it.
Precisely. Before each shift, an officer undertakes a meticulous personal check to ensure they are physically and visually ready for anything. This starts with basic cleanliness and personal grooming.
The basics.
The basics. Their uniform must be tailored, clean, pressed, in good repair, with shined footwear. A well-maintained duty belt and a clearly visible name tag are also essential.
And this isn't just about looking professional.
It's not just about looking good, no. It's about presenting a professional image that projects competence and, as we discussed, directly ties into their mental preparedness and esprit de corps, that sense of shared purpose and pride within the department. Appearance affects attitude.
Okay. And their personal equipment isn't just a grab bag. It's a meticulously chosen toolkit for survival and service. What are some of the non-negotiables they need to have ready?
It is indeed a precision toolkit. Essential personal equipment includes a notebook and pen or pencil for documentation. Their sidearms must be clean, operational, fully loaded with current ammunition, and extra magazines should also be clean and ready.
Ready for anything.
Exactly. Foul weather gear like boots, raincoat, or gloves is crucial as officers work in all conditions. Handcuffs must be clean and operational with keys readily available. Body armor is a non-negotiable. It should be worn at all times while on duty.
Always.
Always. And, of course, a reliable flashlight or two and a traffic whistle are also required for various situations. Each item is there for a reason, supporting their ability to respond effectively and safely.
So we've talked about the officer's internal state, the mental game and their physical readiness, the tools and appearance. But a crucial third pillar, just as important, is knowing their environment, their beat.
Yes, beat knowledge.
This isn't just about knowing where the popular coffee shop is it?
Yeah.
It goes much, much deeper.
Far from it. Knowing your beat characteristics is absolutely crucial, almost like an extension of their own self. Geography, for instance, is fundamental.
Geography.
Officers are expected to learn their city's layout as quickly and thoroughly as possible. This includes main streets, key businesses, schools, hospitals, you name it.
So landmarks.
Landmarks, yes. But also, they need to deeply understand street run directions, which way numbers run on east-west or north-south streets, common block numbers, and even exceptions to the grid, like looping, slashing, or diagonal streets and highways.
Oh, wow, the exceptions too.
Yes. And knowing one-ways, overpasses, dead ends, back roads, alleyways. Imagine looking at a map, like, say, a Denton City map example they might use in training, and understanding not just where the streets are, but how the numbers progress, which ones have exceptions, and how all those tiny details impact travel time.
I can see how that would be incredibly important for shaving off precious seconds in response times, especially in an emergency. Like, knowing the numbering system helps you pinpoint locations faster.
Exactly. The benefits are significant and interconnected. This kind of deep geographical knowledge directly leads to an increase in on-site arrests because officers can anticipate movements and cut off escape routes.
Makes sense.
It profoundly enhances officer safety as they know the safest approach to any location. And, as you mentioned, it critically decreases response time to calls. Understanding how, for example, a city's streets are numbered or which routes might be faster even if they aren't the shortest due to traffic or time of day is invaluable.
So how do they learn this? Just driving around.
Well, that's part of it. Officers are encouraged to literally study maps, pay intense attention while driving, and constantly ask themselves, what street is that? Where does it go? They're building a complex mental GPS that's far more responsive than any electronic device.
So it's about having a real mental map, an internal 3D model of their operational space. Beyond the physical layout, what else should an officer know about the personality of their beat?
That's a great way to put it, the personality. Officers are encouraged to truly learn the personality of their city and district. This means paying close attention during pre-shift briefings and, importantly, actively getting out of the car and getting to know the people.
Face-to-face.
Yes. This helps them understand the socioeconomic and geographic characteristics of the area, building real, tangible connections. It also means being acutely aware of crime and public safety hazards, special events, and known offenders, including their habits, types of crimes, and specific information from state and national criminal intelligence databases, like TCI, CNCIC.
So knowing the potential trouble spots in individuals, what about the smaller everyday issues that might not seem like police business at first glance, but impact a community's sense of safety, like broken streetlights or something?
Don't ignore them. That's the message. Officers are trained not to overlook quality of life issues or what might seem like minor signs of neighborhood decay or apathy.
Examples.
This can include anything from abandoned houses and code violations to dead or neglected animals, non-working streetlights, potholed roads, and unmaintained yards.
Okay.
And this raises an important question. How does understanding these seemingly small, almost mundane details of a community lead to bigger impacts on safety and trust?
Yeah.
By addressing these issues, officers contribute to overall community well-being, often preventing larger problems and fostering stronger community relationships through proactive problem solving. It's about showing care for the small things that truly define a neighborhood's quality of life.
That's a truly comprehensive approach to readiness, covering everything from the internal mindset to the physical toolkit and the external environment. Wow. Now, shifting gears slightly, patrol work, by its very nature, is inherently dangerous.
Extremely so.
This deep dive emphasizes that safety isn't just a best practice. It's absolutely paramount, the foundation for everything else.
Indeed. There are crucial safety guidelines that officers must adhere to rigorously. They should never approach a potentially dangerous situation without first notifying dispatch or their supervisor, and, if needed, waiting for backup.
Never go in alone if it's potentially dangerous.
Right. Similarly, they should never enter a building or structure where criminal activity is suspected without backup. A constant awareness of their police sidearm is vital, and practicing good officer survival techniques is a daily ingrained habit. It has to become second nature.
Okay, one of the most fundamental distinctions for officer safety, something that can literally mean the difference between life and death, is understanding the difference between cover and concealment. Can you clarify that for us with a clear example?
Certainly. This is critical. Cover refers to any material that is reasonably expected to stop a bullet fired from small arms, offering actual physical protection.
Stops bullets like what?
Think of a sturdy brick wall, the engine block of a car, a heavy steel mailbox, or a large tree trunk. These provide a physical barrier against incoming fire.
Okay. And concealment.
Concealment, on the other hand, merely hides you from view but offers no protection from bullets. Think of a thin shrub, a flimsy wooden fence, or a sheetrock wall inside a house. It hides you, but it won't stop much.
So hide-and-seek versus actual protection.
Exactly. The key takeaway is simple but critical. Cover is always preferred. If only concealment is available, officers are trained to use it at the greatest distance possible, buying precious seconds or reducing the chance of being hit.
Can you give a quick scenario?
Sure. In an active shooter scenario, an officer behind a solid brick wall has true cover. An officer behind a flimsy wooden fence only has concealment. Understanding this distinction can be literally life-saving, allowing an officer to choose the safest position to engage or take tactical action.
That's a critical difference with immense consequences.
Yeah.
Beyond that, what are the three main kinds of patrol hazards officers are taught to watch out for? Those subtle things that can give away their position or put them at risk? Here's where it gets really interesting, as the seemingly small details can have massive consequences.
You're right. The small things matter hugely. The first is silhouetting.
Silhouetting, like standing in a doorway at night.
Precisely. It occurs when an officer, other individuals, or even their patrol unit are positioned against a lighter background, creating a definite, easily identifiable target for suspects. It's like standing in front of a bright window at night.
And the danger is.
This gives suspects crucial knowledge of officer numbers, firepower, and their approach, allowing them to plan their actions. To mitigate this, officers carefully select vehicle stop locations with proper lighting control, ensure backup units secure their headlights upon approach, hold flashlights well in front and away from their body, and avoid standing in doorways, hallways, or peering openly through windows.
So blend in, don't stand out.
Essentially, yes. Eliminate any visual advantage for an adversary.
So making yourself a harder target, almost vanishing into the environment. What's the second hazard?
The second hazard is telltale noises. These are unexpected sounds that can instantly alert suspects to an officer's presence and position.
Like what kind of noises?
Common sources include the vehicle engine idling too loudly, parking a unit too close to a scene, the distinct click of seatbelts popping their buckles, letting a unit door slam shut, having the radio volume too loud, or the jingling of equipment like radios, keys, whistles, batons, or handcuffs.
Wow, even keys jingling.
Anything that breaks the silence unnecessarily. The goal is to move silently, almost imperceptibly, and avoid giving away their location before they're ready.
Okay. And the third, and perhaps most dynamic, hazard, which I imagine requires intense focus in any interaction.
That would be suspects' hands. These are a critical focus point because they can conceal contraband, evidence, weapons, or even identifiable marks like scars or tattoos.
Always wash the hand.
Always. Officers are rigorously trained to immediately demand that suspects place their hands in front of them, palms up, and never to allow hands to be put into pockets.
What if they're already in the pockets?
If hands are already in pockets, officers are instructed not to allow their removal without first establishing control, and always to frisk from behind, with the suspect facing away. In high-risk situations, they might even instruct the suspect to kneel or go prone before frisking for weapons. It's all about controlling the immediate threat potential.
So constant laser-like vigilance over the hands. It seems like a lot of what we're discussing is about anticipating and minimizing risk, even from seemingly minor details.
Absolutely. Beyond these direct threats, officers are also responsible for proactively reporting hazards like roadway dangers, dead animals, issues with traffic control devices, or general crime hazards. They contact the appropriate authorities as soon as possible.
Why is that part of their job?
Because it's all part of maintaining overall public safety. Even the seemingly mundane details contribute to a safer environment.
Right, it all connects. It's clear that patrol isn't a one-size-fits-all approach.
Mm-hmm.
Officers employ different strategies to address crime in varying situations, almost like a chameleon adapting to its environment.
That's a good analogy.
What are the two primary types of problem area patrols they use?
You're right. Tactics vary significantly. The first type is preventive patrols.
Okay, preventive.
Within this, you have preventive enforcement, which involves varied, appropriate, and random patrols, visible property checks, questioning suspicious persons, and maintaining a high observable presence. The goal is to deter crime through sheer visibility.
Be seen, basically.
Right. Then there's selective patrol, which is much more targeted. This deals with specific problems at certain times and locations. It requires an officer to be highly aware of the particular problem. For instance, car break-ins, its usual location, and the specific time of day it typically occurs.
So very focused.
Very focused interventions, yes.
So one is broad deterrence, casting a wide net, and the other is highly targeted, almost like a sniper. What's the second main type of patrol?
The second is apprehension patrol. This involves using covert or low visibility tactics and surveillance.
Ah, going unseen.
Exactly. The objective here is not to deter by being seen, but to catch offenders in the act or after the fact by observing their activities discreetly. The key difference is the visibility aspect. Preventive patrols aim to be seen. Apprehension patrols aim not to be seen.
And when would you use each?
Well, each is most effective depending on the specific crime problem and the desired outcome. For instance, if you have a known drug dealer operating at a specific corner, you might use apprehension patrol. If you want to reduce overall speeding, you'd use preventative enforcement with high visibility.
That makes perfect sense. Now, how do officers actually carry out these patrols? I know there are various modes of transportation. What are the key advantages of the different patrol modes?
Each mode offers unique advantages, making it suitable for different situations and environments. Let's quickly run through them.
Okay.
Bicycle patrols offer incredible flexibility in congested urban areas, allowing officers to go where motorized vehicles cannot, like narrow paths or crowded events. This also fosters improved community relations due to the easier person-to-person contact.
Good for cities or campuses.
Exactly. Motorcycle patrols are known for their quick response times and mobility in covering large areas efficiently. They are highly effective in traffic law enforcement and as escort units.
Right.
Foot patrol provides the most intimate person-to-person contact, which is crucial for building trust and gathering intelligence. This mode significantly increases an officer's beat knowledge and allows for immediate traffic control in dense areas. You really get to know the area and people.
Old school, but effective.
Very effective. Mm. Automobile patrol provides unparalleled speed and mobility, covering vast distances quickly. Its high visibility contributes to preventive potential, offers protection to the officer, and allows them to carry extra equipment.
The standard patrol car.
Right. Then you have fixed-wing and helicopter patrols. These are invaluable for enormous area coverage and sky view, which is critical for tracking fleeing persons or vehicles and coordinating with ground units. An excellent apprehension tool when used right.
The eye in the sky.
Precisely. Finally, mounted patrols, utilizing horses, excel in person-to-person contact and community relations, offering excellent visibility in crowds and the ability to pursue suspects effectively in rough terrain.
Horses, still used.
Still used and very effective in certain environments like parks or crowd control.
That's a fascinating range of tools, each tailored to specific needs. And for the most common mode, automobile patrol. Are there specific practical tips officers are given to maintain safety and effectiveness? Little things they need to remember.
Yes, very practical ones that often seem small but have big impacts. Officers are trained to check their vehicle for mechanical defects, contraband, and weapons before starting patrol. Basic readiness.
Pre-flight check.
Exactly. They must remain alert and prepared for any emergency, meaning no zoning out. They are advised to avoid spending too much time in drive-ins or coffee shops, and if another patrol vehicle is already there, they generally shouldn't stop. Visibility matters.
Why not stop if another car is there?
It reduces the overall visible presence in the patrol area if multiple units are clustered together unnecessarily. Better to spread out.
Huh? Okay. Makes sense.
Vehicle conferences between patrol cars should happen on main thoroughfares to maintain visibility and encourage prevented enforcement. They must always watch their driving speed and strictly observe rules of the road, and two absolute non-negotiables for safety. Never leave keys in the vehicle and never park on railroad tracks.
Common sense, but critical reminders. So what does this all mean for how officers work on the street, especially regarding staffing? Do they generally work alone or with a partner, and what drives that decision?
That's a really important operational decision. Agencies weigh the advantages of one officer versus two officer patrols based on resources, risk assessment, and specific community needs. There are pros and cons to both.
Okay, what are the advantages of one officer patrol?
One officer patrol has distinct advantages. It effectively doubles preventive enforcement by having twice as many patrol vehicles on the street, maximizing visible presence. A lone officer often dedicates more focused attention to their patrol functions and duties and tends to develop greater self-reliance.
More independent.
Right. It's also observed that they may take fewer chances, as they are solely responsible for their safety and potential personality clashes within a car are eliminated.
Interesting point about taking fewer chances. What about two officer patrols? What are the benefits there?
Conversely, two officer patrol offers a significantly greater safety factor, providing immediate backup. That's huge. It can also serve as an excellent training aid for new officers, allowing for real-time coaching and correction of mistakes.
Learning on the job.
Exactly. They can share driving duties, providing a fresh perspective. Crucially, two pairs of eyes are better than one for observation, and one officer can operate the radio while the other drives, streamlining communication during dynamic situations.
So it's a trade-off between coverage and safety backup training.
It often comes down to that, yes. And departmental policy, call volume, and the nature of the area being patrolled.
Beyond just patrolling, much of an officer's role involves enhancing public service and winning over the community. It's not always about direct enforcement or making arrests, is it? It's about building bridges.
Not at all. A significant part of their training focuses on five key ways to truly win hearts and minds and foster collaborative safety.
Okay, what are they?
One, visual presence. This means maintaining visibility through vehicular patrols, foot patrols, or other means, simply by being seen as an active, approachable part of the community. Just being there.
Presence again.
Two, non-punitive interaction. This is about simply getting out of the car and talking to people. It's about building rapport and human connection without necessarily responding to a call for service or enforcing a law. It's the casual chat that builds trust.
Just talking.
Three, community involvement. Officers are actively encouraged to participate in public speaking engagements, civic groups, professional organizations, clubs, and service agencies like the YMCA/YWCA or Big Brother Big Sister. This embeds them deeply into the community fabric.
Being part of the community.
Four, seeking citizen input. This can be informal, like stopping to talk during foot patrol, or formal, through questionnaires, prepared questions for civic groups, or even platforms like Crime Stoppers. It's about actively listening to and understanding community concerns, not just dictating solutions.
Listening. Crucial.
Absolutely. And five, service and education. This includes providing public services, using media announcements via a public relations officer for crime prevention tips, radar location announcements, most wanted postings, and establishing citizen police academies.
The citizen police academies. Tell me more.
These academies, often involving community leaders and representatives, provide an overview of policing needs and problems. They cover the police role, budget, crime trends, procedures, legal issues. It's about transparency and education. These actions are fundamental to building community trust and fostering collaborative safety, moving beyond just enforcement to shared responsibility.
That's a powerful shift in perspective, moving from an enforcing authority to a true community partner. And part of being that community leader isn't just knowing the laws, but knowing where to send people for help when a situation isn't a direct police matter.
Yes.
It's about connecting the dots in the broader social support network.
Exactly. Officers are taught to be crucial facilitators, connecting individuals with appropriate community resources when direct enforcement isn't the primary need. This includes vital emergency community resources like ambulances for injuries, the fire department for fires or medical emergencies, or patrol transportation for emergencies.
The obvious ones. What else?
Other crucial referrals can be to the Salvation Army for immediate aid, shelters for battered spouses or children, Rape Crisis Centers, United Way for General Assistance, or Animal Control for animal-related issues. For legal and medical issues, knowing where to contact the medical examiner and justice of the peace is essential.
So a directory of help.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
It's critical that officers know where to refer people, especially to victim service units, because sometimes putting someone in the hands of another agency is the most effective or only way to truly help them.
It sounds like a deep, almost encyclopedic understanding of the entire social support network is expected, truly making them a community hub.
Mm.
Are there any referrals officers shouldn't make? Specific warnings?
Yes, a strict warning is given. Officers should not make specific referrals to private attorneys or bail bondsmen.
Why not?
Doing so could lead to legal issues for the officer or the agency due to perceived conflicts of interest or favoritism.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
However, they are encouraged to be aware of other general referral resources. These include legal services like local lawyer referral services operated by county or district bar associations, and how to file complaints against attorneys if needed. They should also know that the county or district attorney handles the filing of criminal cases or family protective orders.
What about civil stuff, like small disputes?
For civil disputes, small claims court is an option for issues involving smaller monetary values where no attorney is typically required. And citizens can also apply directly to a grand jury to hear a criminal action if they feel a crime has been overlooked. So they need to know these avenues exist.
Good to know. And for more general social issues beyond immediate emergencies, what other types of referrals are important? Things like addiction or mental health?
Definitely. Officers are directed to be aware of various social services. For example, resources for those struggling with addiction, mental health issues, or who need counseling services. They should also know about state departments for child protection, elderly protection, and emergency financial assistance.
A wide net.
A very wide net. Local women's shelters for battered or abused women and children are vital resources, as are local ministers, other religious figures, and civil shelters. It highlights a holistic approach to community well-being.
So the officer serves beyond traditional enforcement.
By facilitating connections to the broader support system, addressing the root causes of problems, and helping people find lasting solutions where possible.
Now we get into the nuts and bolts of how officers directly interact with individuals on the street. The pedestrian stop or ped stop?
Right. The initial contact, often.
This is where a lot of what we've discussed about observation, safety, and community engagement comes together in real time, doesn't it?
Indeed. A ped stop is an initial encounter, and officers are trained on when to perform one. Typically, when a pedestrian is carrying something suspicious, acting strangely, staying in the same place for an unusual amount of time, or stopping other people on the street in a concerning way.
Okay, but what's the legal standing initially?
That's critical. Until an officer has established reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, it remains a consensual stop.
Meaning?
Meaning the person is free to disengage, refuse to answer, and walk away.
Okay, so the location and manner of the stop are also important tactical considerations. You don't just stop someone anywhere.
Absolutely not. Where to perform a ped stop involves tactical considerations for safety. Officers must note potential escape routes, gauge the potential for harm, or if hostages might be involved, should an incident occur, assess their own officer safety, and always report their location to dispatch.
Always let dispatch know where you are.
Always. And how to perform a ped stop emphasizes effective verbal communication and a careful, deliberate approach. This includes maintaining visual contact, ideally approaching on the right side as most people are right-handed.
Why the right side?
It can help keep a suspect slightly off balance or help control their dominant hand more easily. They also constantly watch for furtive movements or attempts to flee, establish early eye contact, and always be aware of their entire surroundings.
Why do officers perform these field inquiries or ped stops in the first place? It seems like it's about gathering intelligence and building a picture beyond just a specific crime.
This isn't just random, you're right. It's profoundly about building a dynamic picture of the environment and gathering crucial intelligence. Officers use ped stops to learn about people.
How so?
This includes observing their reaction to contact and questioning, which can open citizen relationships for future information. It puts the officer on a one-to-one basis with the public, allowing people to personally know officers and potentially feel comfortable sharing information if a rapport is established. Officers also gain insight into the area's socioeconomic makeup and people's routines, travel times, and common types of vehicles.
So intelligence gathering on the human element. Mm-hmm. And they use it to learn about places as well, I imagine, almost like detectives observing their environment.
Yes, it's also about learning about places, Officers develop a keen eye for observable characteristics of houses, buildings, and stores.
Like what kind of things?
An unusual light on or light out at a rear or side entrance to a closed building, no attendant at a cash register, open or broken windows, broken or missing locks, suspicious persons or vehicles in an alley or uncommon area, or even tire tracks across a lawn leading to the back of a building or home.
Tiny details.
Tiny, but potentially significant details. This kind of intelligence gathering is crucial for proactive policing, helping officers identify potential crime hazards and build a comprehensive, living understanding of their beat.
This brings us to a crucial aspect of police interactions: the legal framework that defines when an officer can stop, detain, or arrest someone. This is essential for both officers to understand their authority and for citizens to know their rights, isn't it?
Absolutely critical. We're talking about a graduated scale of interaction, moving from mere suspicion to reasonable suspicion, and finally to probable cause.
Okay, let's break that down. Start at the bottom.
That's right. At ground zero, we have consensual encounters. Here, officers are free to approach and ask questions, engage in conversation. But, and this is key, the individual is just as free to refuse to identify themselves, refuse to cooperate, refuse to answer questions, and simply walk away.
So completely voluntary.
Completely voluntary. There's no legal obligation for the person to stay or provide information. Cases like Florida v. Royer reinforce this. It's essentially a friendly chat initiated by either party that anyone can end.
Okay, so that's just a voluntary interaction. What about when an officer has a bit more than just a gut feeling, a vague sense something is off?
That moves us to level one. Investigatory stop detention, which requires reasonable suspicion.
Reasonable suspicion. What is that exactly?
This is a temporary seizure of a person for investigation based on an officer's articulable facts, things they can specifically point to, that support a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity. The landmark case here is Terry v. Ohio from 1968, which established the stop and frisk doctrine under specific circumstances.
So how do they determine if they have enough articulable facts?
Well, they dissect information, combining various data points, call information, a suspect's appearance, their actions, words, body language, the surrounding circumstances, and their own extensive training and experience. All these articulable facts must add up to a reasonable belief of potential offenses.
Can an anonymous tip be enough?
Usually not by itself. However, as established in Alabama v. White, if an anonymous tip provides descriptive and predictive information, like a car's make, model, and specific route, and that information is sufficiently corroborated by additional police investigation, it can provide reasonable suspicion.
So the tip needs details and needs to be checked out.
Exactly. Officers look for logical inferences they can make upon arrival, comparing the call information with what they observe, looking for furtive, sneaky, alarming, threatening, or strange actions, and noting any contradictions to known information. This helps them build the factual basis for the stop. It's more than a hunch.
Okay, more than a hunch, but less than certainty. And finally, the highest level of interaction, where the facts are strong enough to lead to an arrest.
That's level two. Arrests, which requires probable cause.
Probable cause, the standard we hear a lot about.
Right. This means taking persons into custody for the purpose of charging them with a crime based on facts that would lead reasonable persons to believe a crime has occurred or is occurring. A key case here is U.S. v. Mendenhall.
And how is probable cause determined? Is it after the fact?
No, that's a critical point. Courts determine its presence by examining the totality of the circumstances known to the officer at the exact time of the seizure or search.
At that moment.
At that precise moment. This is incredibly important because any evidence found after the arrest or during the search will not be admissible to retroactively prove probable cause that existed beforehand. You can't justify the arrest with what you find during the arrest search.
So it's all about what the officer knew at that precise moment of the arrest, based on their observations and available information, not what they found later.
Precisely. As Illinois v. Gates stated, probable cause is a practical, non-technical conception based on factual and practical considerations of everyday life. It's about probabilities, not absolute certainty.
How do they build up to probable cause during an investigation?
To complete an investigation for probable cause, officers conduct further investigation, engage in further suspect interaction, and perform follow-up investigations. This could involve contacting witnesses, looking for new witnesses, corroborating information, checking for possessions like crime tools or contraband, collecting forensic evidence, performing ID and warrant checks, conducting frisk searches for weapons if justified, or obtaining confessions or consent searches.
So it's a building process.
It's a process of gathering enough credible facts.
So what does this all mean for you, the citizen, when interacting with law enforcement? It means understanding these different levels, consensual, reasonable suspicion, probable cause, can help clarify when you can socially walk away versus when an officer has a legal basis to detain or even arrest you.
Exactly. It's about a spectrum of engagement, each with its own clear legal thresholds that protect both the public and empower officers to act when necessary.
Now, let's get into the practical techniques of performing a pedestrian stop, moving beyond just the legal aspects. This is about tactics and acute awareness to ensure both officer and public safety in what can sometimes be very unpredictable encounters.
A critical instruction is that pedestrian stops should always be done out of the car, meaning on foot.
Why on foot?
It allows for better observation, better control, and a more personal, direct interaction. When positioning themselves, officers are taught to keep their gun side away from the subject, ensure nothing is in their gun hand, and maintain an offset stance at a minimum distance of 3 to 3.5 feet, roughly arm's length.
Minimum distance. Can they stand further back?
Oh, yes. The situation or a person's disposition might dictate even more distance. They are also constantly scanning their surroundings, not just the person.
Is there a preferred side to approach a suspect? We mentioned the right side earlier.
The right side is often preferred, as most people are right-handed, which can help keep a suspect slightly off balance or control their dominant hand. A direct front approach allows officers to observe all movements, but it sacrifices the element of surprise. A rear approach gains surprise and reduces the probability of a direct attack, but might provoke a startled physical defense due to the suddenness.
So pros and cons to each approach.
Right. Positioning can vary based on the situation, but the goal is always safety and control.
This constant scanning you mentioned, it sounds incredibly detailed and intuitive. What are the 4 personal contact risk zones that officers are continuously scanning, almost without thinking about it?
These zones are vital for quickly assessing potential threats and intentions. The officer's best chance for survival and safety is a continuous, rapid scan of these 4 areas.
Okay, what's the first one?
1, face and chest. This helps determine if the person is friend or foe, looking for signs of an officer, victim, or witness. Officers observe facial expressions for intent or purpose, watch for furtive movements upon their arrival, and check for a history of violence.
What kind of expressions?
Signs of being under the influence, grief, anxiety, fear, anger, or mental health crises. Specific danger signs include breaking eye contact to look for targets, paling facial color, or the head dropping forward to protect the throat, often a precursor to an attack. The 1,000-yard stare is another red flag.
Wow. Intense observation. What's zone 2?
2, hands. Officers constantly ask, are they holding something important? Ideally, hands are cupped in front and palms up. Hands in pockets or out of sight are immediate red flags, as they can be hiding contraband, evidence, or weapons.
We talked about hands in pockets before.
Yes. If hands are already in pockets, officers are trained not to allow their removal without first establishing control, and always to frisk from behind, with the suspect facing away. Signs of anxiety, like tapping fingers, or anger, like fist making, are also noted here.
Okay. Face, chest, hands. What's 3?
3. Waistband. This is a very common place for weapons. Officers look for any bulges under the shirt or in pockets in this area and keep the subject's hands away from it. Accelerated breathing might also be noticeable here, indicating stress or preparation for action.
The waistband check. Got it. And the 4th zone.
4. Stance. A person's stance and body language can reveal their intentions. Officers look for telltale signs like bobbing or rocking, bladed or tense shoulders, standing tall to maximize height, kicking the ground, pacing, backing away, or any start and stop behavior. Exaggerated movements or lower body movements right before an attack are also key indicators.
That's an incredible amount of observational detail that becomes almost instinctual, I imagine. How do these tactics change when there's more than one officer or more than one person involved in an encounter? Does it get more complex?
The tactics adapt to the number of people present to maximize safety and control. It does get more complex.
How so? Like one officer, one person?
One officer with one person. The officer maintains the field interview position, gun side away, arm's length or more, gun hand free, and maintains overall observation of the person and their surroundings. Pretty standard.
Okay. One officer, multiple people.
One officer with multiple persons. This gets trickier. The officer uses the field interview position for overall observation and physical control, but importantly, interviews individuals separately and away from one another if possible. Crucially, they seek backup before any non-emergency police actions and continuously move as needed to prevent being closed in or surrounded.
Safety in numbers, or lack thereof. What about two officers, one person?
Two officers with one person. The officer initiating contact, the contact officer, takes all precautions and leads the interaction. The second officer, the cover officer, takes a position to the right or left rear of the person being interviewed, specifically to avoid a crossfire situation and maintain a wide field of view.
Okay, contact and cover. What if it's two officers and multiple people?
Two officers with two or more persons. The contact officer proceeds as described, leading the primary interaction. The cover officer assumes a position that allows maximum visibility of all persons involved. The cover officer avoids lengthy conversations that would detract from their primary safety awareness and communicates any observations of threats or hazards to the primary officer immediately.
And what are the specific vital duties of that cover officer? Are they just there as backup, or is their role more nuanced? Seems critical.
No, the cover officer is not the contact officer's servant. Their role is distinct and absolutely critical. They must maintain a position of maximum visibility of all involved parties on scene. They should strictly avoid lengthy conversations that would detract from their primary cover duty, and they are responsible for communicating or handling any threat observations immediately without hesitation. Their vigilance is paramount to the safety of everyone on scene.
Okay. This all sounds incredibly dynamic and requires split-second judgment. What about foot pursuits? That seems inherently risky. When does an officer decide to pursue someone on foot, and when do they decide not to?
The decision to engage in a foot pursuit is serious and governed by strict guidelines for officer and public safety. Officers are trained not to pursue if they are alone with multiple subjects.
Outnumbered.
Right. In that case, they should immediately broadcast a description and direction of travel instead. They also should not pursue if it leaves their partner in an unsafe situation. You don't abandon your partner.
Makes sense. When is it okay then?
Otherwise, pursuit is permissible if it's safe and within departmental policy, which varies by agency. Risk versus reward, essentially.
And if they do pursue, how do they do it safely, given how chaotic it can be? Running full tilt, obstacles.
When pursuing on foot, officers must radio in a loud, calm, controlled voice, stating their call sign, confirming it's a foot pursuit, giving direction and location, and following up with a clear suspect description. Communication is key.
Keep dispatch informed.
Absolutely. They must watch for ambushes and pie corners, meaning clearing tactical corners cautiously before rounding them to avoid surprises. And if they catch the suspect, the advice is that tripping is better than tackling, to maintain control and reduce injury risk for both parties.
Tripping, not tackling. Interesting.
It's about control and minimizing injury. It's a highly dangerous and intense situation, demanding extreme awareness and calculated risk. And this raises an important question. How does this meticulous observation and training help an officer make those critical split-second assessments in such a high-stakes, dynamic environment?
Yeah.
It has to become a finely tuned instinct built on repetition and training.
We've been discussing how officers operate within a strict legal framework, but sometimes in the real world, time is of the essence. The Fourth Amendment generally requires warrants for searches and seizures, but there are critical situations where immediate action is necessary.
Right. Life doesn't always wait for paperwork.
Exactly. These are known as legal exigencies, a fascinating area where the law acknowledges urgent circumstances.
That's right. These are specific, well-defined, accepted exceptions to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement. They are justified by truly urgent circumstances that demand immediate action to prevent specific harms.
Okay, what qualifies as an exigency?
Well, there are several key ones. First, preventing serious injury and providing emergency aid. This covers situations where someone is in immediate danger.
Right.
For instance, if officers are dispatched to a family violence call and hear screaming from the back of the residence with no answer at the door, they have an exigency to enter to prevent injury. Or finding a suicidal person who has just taken pills and is unresponsive, they can enter to render aid.
Saving a life takes priority. What else?
Second, preventing the imminent destruction or loss of evidence. If officers observe evidence like drugs being actively destroyed, for example, two subjects cooking what appears to be heroin, and one sees the officer and runs to the back of the residence to flush it, they can act immediately to prevent its loss.
Can't let the evidence disappear. Makes sense.
Third, hot fresh pursuit of a felony offense. If an officer witnesses a felony, like a robbery, and is in continuous pursuit of the suspect, they can follow that suspect into a building without a warrant. the pursuit itself constitutes the exigency.
Chasing a fleeing felon. Okay.
Fourth, imminent or immediate escape. If a suspect is about to escape custody or avoid apprehension, immediate action may be taken to prevent it, rather than risking their escape while seeking a warrant.
Gotta stop them from getting away.
And fifth, hot pursuit of a non-felony with reasonableness and or another exigency. This is a bit more nuanced, but it allows pursuit for lesser offenses if there's a compelling reason, like a minor drinking beer and then fleeing into an apartment, especially if there's a risk to the minor or public safety, or if evidence could be destroyed. Reasonableness is key here.
So for each of these, the urgency overrides the typical warrant requirement because there's an immediate critical threat to life, safety, or the integrity of an investigation.
Exactly.
The law acknowledges that waiting for a warrant in these specific scenarios would be impractical and potentially dangerous.
Precisely. These are situations where immediate action is not just permissible, but necessary to protect life, prevent further crime, or preserve crucial evidence. The framework ensures that officers can act decisively when true emergencies arise, without legal hindrance, always within defined boundaries.
So what does this all mean for making actual decisions on the street? How do officers synthesize all this incredibly complex information, the legalities, the hazards, the tactics, the community aspect, into actionable steps, especially when things are moving fast and under immense pressure?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It really is. This is where the critical decision-making model, or CDM, comes back into play, serving as the organizing principle for all patrol actions.
Yes, the CDM. We mentioned it at the start. It's an organized, dynamic way of making decisions, particularly in situations that may involve uses of force, but really it applies to every interaction an officer has.
And it's more than just steps, right? It has a core philosophy.
It does. Its core is truly the agency's moral compass, unique to its missions, values, and ethics. No step should contradict this core. It also acknowledges the pervasive nature of implicit bias, those subconscious attitudes or stereotypes that can affect one's understanding, decisions, and actions.
Especially under pressure.
Especially in split-second moments. The model helps officers to recognize and account for these biases, fostering a more fair and impartial response.
What are the main benefits of using such a structured model in such a fluid, often chaotic environment? It seems almost counterintuitive to follow steps when adrenaline is pumping.
It might seem that way, but the CDM offers several significant benefits that become almost intuitive with practice and training. It organizes and structures the decision-making process, leading to better, more consistent outcomes.
Structure and chaos.
Exactly. It's also known as the spinning model because it explicitly acknowledges the need for urgent or split-second decisions, allowing officers to cycle through its steps rapidly as circumstances change. It's not rigidly linear.
Okay, spinning model. Yep. I like that.
Crucially, it assists officers in reporting their actions via a structured, rational, and credible explanation after an incident. For example, an officer can articulate, "First, I collected the following information. Next, I assessed the threats and risks. Then, I considered applicable laws and agency policies."
So it helps justify their actions later.
It provides clarity, transparency, and accountability. It helps them explain the why behind their actions.
And what are the key principles that underpin the entire CDM, guiding every decision within it? The moral compass you mentioned.
The CDM is guided by four core unchanging principles. Robust police ethics, the fundamental values of the police agency. Proportionality in response, meaning the response should fit the level of the threat or resistance. And the absolute sanctity of human life.
Ethics, values, proportionality, sanctity of life. Those are the pillars.
Those are the guiding stars for every decision made within the model.
Let's walk through the five steps of the CDM in detail, as it's truly a continuous, circular process that officers constantly cycle through. What's step one?
Okay. Step one, collect information. This is an ongoing process that begins the moment an officer receives a call or observes something. It never really stops.
Where do they get info?
Officers gather information from various sources. Dispatch, supervisors, other officers, computer networks, involve parties like family, friends, witnesses, neighbors. It's vital to clarify any assumptions, recognize potential biases, and deeply understand the context of the situation.
What kinds of questions are they asking themselves?
Key questions. Who called and why? Are there weapons present, children, or animals on scene that could impact safety? What's the history of previous calls to this location? Mental health issues, drug use, violence, prior arrests? What are the location dynamics? Is the security, is containment needed?
And connecting it to their training.
Yes. Officers also deeply draw on their training and experience, constantly asking themselves, what does my training and experience tell me about this situation? This is where they perform that legal math in their head we talked about.
Reasonable suspicion, probable cause.
Exactly. Rapidly assessing if the facts equate to reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or maybe nothing actionable at all. Step one is foundationally about obtaining the proper context for the call and forming the optimal mindset before acting as time allows.
Okay, collect information. Once they have that initial information and context, what's the next critical step?
Step two, assess situation, threats, and risks. Here, officers rapidly analyze the information they just gathered.
What are they assessing specifically?
Key questions. What are the threats or risks, and at what level, low, high, or unknown? Is immediate action needed right now to address an imminent threat? If not, what more information is required, particularly regarding crisis issues or the immediate threat level?
They also assess themselves, right?
Yes, critically. They assess their own capability. Am I trained and equipped to handle this alone? What could make the situation worse or better? Do I need specialized resources like a supervisor, SWAT, a negotiator, or a canine unit?
And the person they're dealing with.
They consider the source of any malice or aggression from a subject, actively working to keep complacency and their own emotions in check and avoiding malice transfer, letting one person's aggression unfairly affect their interaction with another.
Okay, so assessment leads to.
This is where a working strategy starts to develop. Assessing the suspect's means, ability, opportunity, and intent, especially concerning weapons. The overarching goal is to minimize risk to victims, the public, the scene, the subject, and the officers themselves, allowing for safe detention, arrest, or evidence recovery. They constantly ask, is immediate action needed right now? Strategy begins here.
So after assessing the threats and risks, they must ground their response in the legal and policy framework, right? That seems logical.
Yes, that's step three. Consider police powers and agency policy. This step grounds the response firmly in law and departmental guidelines. Can't just make it up as you go.
What questions guide this step?
Officers ask, under what legal authority am I here? Why am I involved? Is this even a matter for the police or does it fall to another agency? What specific legal powers do I have to take action in this situation? What agency policies control my response here? And are there others I should be notifying to respond or be aware of, like a supervisor?
So checking the rule book, essentially.
Ensuring accountability and adherence to established protocols, yes.
And then putting it all together to decide on a course of action, which can be incredibly dynamic. Step four.
That's step four. Identify options and determine best course of action. This is where the spinning the model concept truly comes alive.
How so?
Officers asked, do I have to act now or can I spin back to step one or two to collect more information or reassess? The CDM is a circular and continuous process as things can change quickly, requiring officers to constantly reassess and adapt.
It's not a straight line.
Not at all. Mm. Tactical considerations come into play. Repositioning for safety, establishing containment, and maintaining continued communication, emphasizing vigilance, active listening, and clear communication as vital throughout.
And choosing the best option.
They evaluate which options best fit the core CDM principles, ethics, values, proportionality, sanctity of life, and ensure proportionality in the response. Remember, why use a sledgehammer to crack a nut when a tap will do?
Right, tool for the job.
Exactly. They also rapidly develop backup plans and contingencies for the chosen option, always having a plan B, ideally. This step is where the CDM allows officers to use any available time effectively, however brief, to make the most informed and ethical decision.
And the final step sounds like a crucial feedback loop that constantly refines an officer's skills. Step five.
It is. Step five. Act, review, and reassess. Officers take their best action based on the previous steps and then immediately monitor and assess the results of that action.
Did it work?
That's the question. Did it resolve the situation successfully? Or do they need to spin the model back to another step and keep working on the problem, perhaps gathering more info, step one, or reassessing threats, step two, or considering different options, step four?
And the learning part.
Crucially, self-reflection should occur after the incident is over, allowing officers to identify lessons learned, what worked, what didn't, what could be improved. These lessons are then applied in future situations, continually refining their skills over time. This crucial feedback loop continually refines an officer's ability to make critical split-second assessments and improve future responses.
What an incredibly detailed and thoughtful process that underpins every action. This deep dive has truly laid bare the complex and vital world of patrol for peace officers.
Wow, it's a lot to take in.
It really is.
Yeah.
We've explored everything from the core mission of patrol, which extends far beyond simply apprehending suspects, to the meticulous mental and physical preparation required for daily duties. We've delved into understanding the inherent hazards of the job and the countermeasures taken, examined the diverse methods of patrol, and highlighted the profound importance of community engagement.
Mm-hmm.
We've also unpacked the crucial levels of police interaction, from consensual encounters to reasonable suspicion and probable cause, and finally, walked through the overarching critical decision-making model, which guides every action on the street, ensuring thoughtful and ethical responses. It really aimed to give that comprehensive understanding, especially for someone new to this.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the constant evolution of challenges in public safety means that the principles we've discussed, clear decision-making, meticulous preparation, community engagement, they aren't just for peace officers.
How so?
Well, they are powerful frameworks we can all apply to navigate complex information and make better choices in our own lives. And importantly, to better understand the decisions made by those who serve our communities.
That's interesting, applying it more broadly.
Think about it. The structured approach to problem solving, the emphasis on comprehensive information gathering, rigorous risk assessment, identifying options, considering ethics and proportionality, these are truly universal tools for effective action in any complex situation.
Whether you're navigating a professional challenge or making a critical personal decision.
Exactly. It provides a way to think through complex issues logically and ethically.
It's a powerful thought, isn't it? How might these principles apply to your own field or even your daily decision making? We encourage you, the listener, to consider that and perhaps gain an even deeper appreciation for the structured, thoughtful approach required in a role as vital and demanding as public safety.